Stay tuned for The Lynn Show. Today, I'm going to talk about the kinds of things that get between us and being who we really are. And I'm going to give an example of that. Then, I'm going to play a review by Sharon Leslie of Boeing Boeing, a farce which is currently on stage at the Oslo Repertory Theater in Sarasota, Florida. And after that, an interview with Brian Torfey, one of the stars of Boeing Boeing. So, hang on. Here come the show.
Hearing from an inner voice, finding choice where there's no choice, with gentle prodding from
welcome to The Lynn Show. The Lynn Show is all about discovering who you really are. What does that mean? Well, it kind of means who you would have been if nothing had interrupted the natural evolution of whatever it is you came into life with. Whatever talents, skills, abilities, capacities, whatever, what would you have been like if nothing had gotten in the way? If no parent had gotten sick, if no sibling had been born before you, if you'd been a boy instead of a girl or a girl instead of a boy, if your parents had had some feeling about what it meant to be a boy or a girl that didn't have anything to do with who you were, if you were not the first child or the last child, if you didn't look like your mother's uncle who everybody hated, if you hadn't gotten sick very young and gotten a reputation as somebody who was sick, if your parents had been well and happy, not divorced, not gotten sick, not been alcoholic, not fought with each other, these are the kinds of things that happen in one way or another to everybody. So, in my experience as a psychotherapist, and I suppose this is the time for me to say that I am currently in private practice entirely on the telephone, and if you are curious about what phone therapy is like, You can go up on my website. Well, actually, if you're curious about me, and if you're curious about the kinds of things I talk about, which mostly exist in the book I wrote, which is called When You Can, You Will, Why You Can't Always Do What You Want to Do and What to Do About It. So if you want to know about me, if you want to know about the book, if you want to know about phone therapy, there's an article that I wrote about phone therapy called Psychotherapy on the Go. Oh, and the old podcasts of the show. So if you're relatively new to the show, or if you've been listening for a long time but you remember that I said something in an old show that you would like to hear again, the podcasts for all the last 3 years are up on that website. I am in the process of updating the website, so if you've been there before, you might want to take another look, see how I've changed it, and how it is going to be changed in the future. The website is thelynshow.com, thelynneshow. Don't leave the E out of Lynn, thelynshow.com. There is apparently another The Lynn Show, and you you won't find out what I think about why we all have placed parts of ourselves out of reach. That is, that we are in denial for so many things that we could have done, could have been, because they hit obstacles, like the ones I was talking about a few minutes ago. So let's say that you had the capacity to be a really terrific athlete. Let's say you have an athlete's body, right? And a terrific amount of energy and great coordination. And this is just a gift of being you. This comes with the territory of that body that you got. But you had a mother who was very, very frightened that something bad would happen to you, and so she didn't let you play games, or she stood on the sideline going, oh my God, oh my God, oh my God, or she actually punished you when she caught you with a ball or whatever. So you can see how what you might have been, could have been, actually are, could have become too dangerous. None of us wants to upset, scare, anger, offend, depress, frighten our parents. And so in this, just in this one instance, this little boy or girl would have grown up shying away from something that could have, and in my belief system, should have given that little boy and girl a tremendous amount of pleasure. Never mind that it could have felt like the thing, right? Home, who I really am. And it's not only that this little boy or girl that I'm talking about doesn't get to experience that, the pleasure of something that would have been so easy for him or her, but such a person may always feel a little bit out of sync, never quite find what feels like home, what feels like me. So that's just one example. In my practice, I run over and over and over into people who have had experiences in their childhood that suggest to them that they are not, or should not, or cannot be what they already are. And sometimes you can even see it. Sometimes a person is quite beautiful, but they don't believe it. That is because they were either not told, or they were told they were not, or they were told that vanity is a sin, and to speak of yourself or think of yourself as beautiful is a dreadful thing and will bring down a parent's, criticism, condemnation, maybe even punishment, right? So such a person will deny absolutely what is blatantly clear to anybody with eyes. And this can be true about lots and lots and lots of things. I had a client who very, very capable, very, very talented, very, very smart, but felt that this was not true. And one of the ways that she managed to get in her way so that she didn't have to demonstrate how smart she was or how capable she was that she created a problem. She just couldn't get anywhere on time. And this inability to get places on time made her seem like a flake, not only to herself, but to everybody else. Now, why would a person with real talent, real capacity do that? Well, she had parents who wanted to have a dependent child. She had parents who were so in love with the idea of being parents that they only wanted to take care of their little girl. And they felt so good when they were taking care of their little girl. And when it looked like their little girl could take care of herself, they felt like they weren't needed. What happened to their job? What happened to their life? What were they going to do now? So every time that little girl showed signs of her capacity, they let her know in no uncertain terms that that was not all right. And even now, when she was married, they would slip her money on the side so that she could do little things for herself and didn't have to be completely dependent on her husband. And, of course, so that she would always know that she could be and would be forever dependent on her parents. Now, our unconscious makes these decisions. It knows what's going on. So let's just take this example of this young woman. Her unconscious learned very early that any expression of her ability brought unpleasantness. So it started to hide her ability from her. And it created this problem about getting places on time, so that she was never in danger of having to accept, recognize, dare I say, enjoy who she really is. Now, of course, that became the subject of the work that we did in therapy. That's what therapy is about. Well, one of the things therapy is about, and for me, one of the major things that therapy is about. Of course, people come into therapy expressing things they want to do differently. So this young woman came into therapy expressing that she needed to do something about this time management problem because it was making it impossible for her to pursue her career. However, once we started to look at because I believe that problems serve functions. You don't create a problem unless it's doing something for you. And, of course, we can always see the way it's getting in our way. That's why people bring these problems into therapy. But we can't always see how it's acting in our interest. So as we began to explore the circumstances in which she was late, the circumstances in which she managed to get there on time, and most especially her early life experiences, her relationship with her parents, and parenthetically her relationship with her husband, because he was another one who liked the caretaking role, and he thought it was adorable that he had this charming, really talented but somewhat flaky wife who needed his care. So at this point in the work, I explained to this young woman about the relationship contract. And if you're curious about the relationship contract, I will be talking about that in future shows. And the way that the relationship contract, which we establish with virtually everyone in our life, sets the perimeters, the boundaries, to things which we can and cannot do easily, creates obstacles to changing in ways we might want to change. And, of course, one of the ways in which we might want to change well, at least one of the ways I think we should all want to change, is in discovering and recovering parts of ourselves which we had hidden. So, for example, with this young woman, to be able to know and to use and to benefit from her capability and her talent without throwing the obstacle of not being able to get anywhere on time or the cover story of I Am a Flake in the path. The relationship contract creates boundaries, perimeters. And as I said, I will talk more about it. I have talked about it a little bit in previous shows, and you can find that in the podcasts if you go up on my website. Or, obviously, I talk about it in the book. So if you go up on the website and get the book, you can read about it. But I will be talking about it in future shows. The other thing I do in my show is I interview people who make their living or their life with an art. And the reason I do that is because in order to do that in our culture, it really has to be who you really are. And you hear over and over again in all of the interviews that I do with these people, and that is painters, dancers, architects, fine artists, and in the case of Brian Torfey, actors, that they couldn't help it. And in Brian's case, it's really kind of interesting because Brian tried to help it. Brian tried to resist. Brian has a really interesting and somewhat unusual, well, not somewhat, very unusual experience on his path to becoming what he is, which is an actor, and that is that his family wanted him to do that, and he tried not to do that. So until he discovered that it was who he was, and he has given his life to acting. So this is a curious, interesting, and amusing story. Before the interview with Brian, I am playing a review of one of the plays that Brian is in at the Oslo Repertory Theater Company at present. And you hear that repertory shows up in the title of the company, and that is because that is what it is. It's a repertory company, and all of the actors are in many shows. Brian has two very compelling, difficult roles, and he's going to talk about both of them in this interview. If you were listening to my last several shows, you heard an interview with David Herson, who wrote La Bête, which is one of the plays that Brian is in, and he will talk a lot about it. And I think last month I played an interview with Danny Shea, who plays Val Lehrer in La Bête, opposite Brian, who is playing Elomir. And also Brian is Bernard in Boeing Boeing, the review of which is following. And in a show to come, you'll hear an interview with Jason, who Sharon mentions also her in her interview, and so does Brian. So, Sharon Leslie's review of Boeing Boeing, followed by my interview with Brian.
Hi, this is Sharon Leslie with another theater review. Boeing Boeing, or as I like to call it, Boing Boing, is one of those wonderful farces that has its characters bouncing around the stage like a ball in a pinball machine. Does anyone still remember a pinball machine? Originally written in French and then translated into English, this 1960s-era comedy just closed a successful run on Broadway. It begins with a mildly sedate opening in which the author, Mark Camaletti, lays the groundwork of information. A handsome American architect living in Paris, Bernard, is engaged to a fellow American stewardess, we note, a harried maid dropping hints of exasperation about what we haven't yet heard, while Bernard the architect shows some anxiety as he hurries his fiancée out of the apartment to catch her plane on time. Into this slightly quirky scene enters a whirlwind of energy, Robert, a friend from Bernard's college days. Bernard lets Robert in on a secret. He is actually engaged to 3 airline stewardesses that he juggles adeptly according to their airline schedules. 1 is a Palin-esque American. The 2nd one, a sultry Italian. And the 3rd, a commanding but kittenish German. Each lady doesn't know about the others. And when a faster Boeing jet and rough weather jumbles all 3 women's timetables, chaos reigns as each lady pops in and out of doors. How it all ends, well, you'll just have to go see this Oslo repertory production to find out. As Bernard, Brian Torfa is charming amidst the frantic goings-on. As each twist comes, he elevates to a marvelous level of anxiety as the danger and risk increase. Each of the stewardesses, Kim Hausler, Angela Sauer, and Kate Hampton, play their respective stereotypes with aplomb. Mercedes Herrera was amusing as the maid, but best of all was Jason Bradley as the whirlwind Robert. How he contorts his body and plays the physical humor while maintaining an air of innocence is magic to watch. He doesn't just steal the show, he wins it by establishing the pace and energy necessary for a good farce to play well. Watching the authentic mini-skirted costumes and polyester shirts swirling around the colorful 1960s-style set with the flamboyant staging by director Greg Linning gives this production an amusing kaleidoscope kind of motion. While Boeing Boeing was a staple of dinner theaters through the 70s and was made into a movie starring Tony Curtis and Jerry Lewis, the change in seeing it now in 2011 is that we can laugh at the era instead of at ourselves. Silliness in miniskirts and poochy prints is probably more funny now than it ever has been. If you like farces, and I do, you'll enjoy the Oslo Repertory's production of Boeing Boeing. It runs through April 23rd.
I am here with Brian Torfa in what is apparently the Oslo's extra rehearsal space. Huge, cold place.
And we could at any moment have a customer walk in looking for tile.
Oh, yes, it used to be a tile, that's right. And there are signs on the door which are very confusing. And right, so people may come in looking for tile. Brian doesn't know anything about what I do, so I'm going to explain it to him.
Excellent.
I interview people who make their living or their life with an art.
Mm-hmm.
And I know that's true for you,
mm-hmm.
right? And the art with which you have spent your life is acting.
Mm-hmm.
And I always ask the same question. And it is, how did it happen?
Mm-hmm.
How did it capture you? How did you find it? How did it find you?
Well, I was raised by parents who definitely considered the arts to be the highest calling there was, which helped. They were both very practical people, but they were both very, very enamored of music. And so we were very much, all 3, my brothers and I, were all very much guided toward music and music lessons and all that sort of thing.
So you play?
I play lots of instruments. My brother is a professional cellist and plays lots of instruments. But I rebelled against all that because, and I announced at 14 that I wanted to go to law school.
Oh my God!
And you've never seen a more disappointed father.
This is a very unique story.
Exactly.
This is truly one of them. I've not heard this before. Oh, my God. That's great.
But, I mean, it reflects back because my father was an actor,
mm-hmm.
very much without the knowledge of his family. So all the time he was officially studying engineering, he was actually going to drama school in England. And unbeknownst to them, he had joined a professional company in England.
So you were essentially doing what he did.
I'm living his dream.
No, I mean, you they wanted you to be something and you chose to be something else, which is what he did, mm-hmm. right? And then, that's right, you lived his dream.
Well, he wanted to be an actor, and he went to Los Angeles to be an actor. And eventually with the family, of course, he had to get more practical, and he did, in the end, spend his life as an engineer.
Oh, my God.
Doing community theater and that kind of thing. But when I went to university then, officially to prepare for law school, of course I was instantly seduced by Shakespeare and Shaw and started acting in plays from my very first term. And I had a wonderful academic advisor who, before my third year, said, you know, Brian, you haven't done any courses for your major, but you have done about 14 plays. Maybe you should reconsider.
Really interesting. I mean, you would think that a lot of academic advisors would not have come to that conclusion.
Yeah. Brilliant, brilliant man.
Truly.
One of the best Shakespeare scholars in the world. And I ended up sort of spending my university days studying Shakespeare and acting. And
so did you complete law school? I mean, did you...
Never went to law school.
No.
I did my undergraduate in Shakespeare and dramatic literature. And then my professors very much encouraged me to go on to drama school. And it came down to a choice between Yale or Guildhall in England.
Mm.
And my father, of course, said, well, you're not properly trained unless you train in England.
Uh-huh.
And
by now, very happy to...
He was always... Both my parents came to see everything I did, no matter what. Wherever it was, they would fly and come to see it.
Oh.
So, so I had a choice of Stamford, Connecticut, or London, and I think we know.
Yeah.
And, London, well, of course, and acting in America was, I had done a couple of summers, and I thought, gosh, this is no way for a grown-up to make a living, because actors in America were very much itinerant gypsies, kind of doing regional theater and living out of their cars, and I thought, well, drama school will be fun, but, you know, it won't be a way of making a living.
Still, you're finessing it.
Finessing it? Well, no, but what happened is I went to England, so this is in the 80s.
Right.
And in England, I met actors who had mortgages and families.
Ah.
And I thought, oh, I see, this can actually be a grown-up way of making a living. So I stayed in England and made my career there. I have to say, England has now gone the way of America, where actors are gypsies.
Right.
And, you know, in those days, British actors didn't have survival jobs. American actors always have survival jobs.
Yes, right.
Now, all British actors have survival jobs, unless you're one of the 1%.
What happened?
The industry shrinks. The industry is always shrinking. And in Britain, it's become the unemployment system has become much worse than America. It used to be much better than America. Now it's become much worse than America.
So you mean that when actors weren't working, they could receive unemployment, so they didn't have to have a survival job? That's what you mean.
But they would, in the 80s, an actor might be out of work for a couple of weeks between gigs. That was it.
Well, now, so this brings up another question. Mm. Well, several. I have so many questions. Well, I'm interested to hear you say that you were concerned about making a living, being able to have a family or a house or whatever, which was really kind of what got your father off the track, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I'm just curious, where are you in the birth order of your family?
I'm the youngest.
You're the youngest.
Performers are almost always the youngest.
Yes, quite often they are. Quite often they are. But it does seem like you modeled your father in a lot of ways, that you were, right?
He was also the youngest.
Oh, was he?
Yeah.
I see. Okay. So, do you think if you had not met actors with mortgages and families, that you would not have done it?
I think I would have done summer Shakespeare. You know, the main source of employment for American actors is summer Shakespeare or summer stock. So yes, I think I probably would have, had I not seen what I saw in England, I probably would have come back to the States and done summer theater and
had a regular gig.
Had a regular a real life in the rest of the year, something like that.
Right, and that would have been okay.
That would have been okay. The people I think who've got it really figured out are the people who have university teaching jobs but manage to schedule, keep open enough of their summer to do a summer Shakespeare. That's a very nice way to live.
Did that never occur to you?
I looked into it. I did a lot of teaching. I did.
You're
chuck
certainly
it all
qualified.
In.
I mean, you're right.
Yeah. I did. I kind of got burned out on acting in my late 20s. I did so much of it because I was very workaholic in my 20s, and so by my late 20s, I wanted something more exciting in life, and I wanted to travel. I've always had the travel bug, and you know, my family's very international, so I applied for teaching jobs around the world, kind of thing, and I got a teaching job running a drama program in Jakarta, Indonesia, which was pretty fantastic.
Wow.
So I was teaching and directing there for a couple of years, and I really got the directing bug. And so when I finished that, I thought, yeah, I'll go for a university job in Britain or in America. And of course, what you realize when you're looking at drama and theater jobs is that universities expect a lot of work for very little money.
Aha.
And compared to acting, it's a lot of work. You know, as an actor, if you're working, you get pretty, by the hour, you're paid pretty well, depending what contract you're on. Whereas as a teacher and a lecturer, not so much.
Not so much. No, and there's another question here, and that is acting the same kind of work as teaching would be? I mean, is it as... No.
No, it's not. I mean, the thing about directing and teaching was that I did feel that I was using 98% of my brain.
Yes.
Whereas it has to be said, as an actor, you're using 40 or 50% of your brain. That's because you have to just be willing to go into that world, and you are always an employee, you're always on someone else's schedule.
Boy, you have a real, I dare say, conflict, it's what it sounds like, is this, the need really to use 98% of your brain, to feel like you are completely engaged, right? And yet, the desire to be an actor, which doesn't do that, so are you getting something from acting that's so compelling?
Well, there's a life change that happens. So I would say, yes, in your 20s and 30s, when you're ambitious and workaholic, yes, of course, I wanted to use my whole brain. And I have to say, now, I'm very happy not to have to use my whole brain, because my whole brain is engaged more with having a life and having fun and, you know, my social life and my, I'm addicted to houses. I'm always messing with houses and renovating houses and hobbies and
yes. So you have now, you found lots of things to which to give 98%
right.
of your brain.
Right.
So you can play.
Exactly. Because so I get to be a child.
Exactly.
Which is what actors are. You get to be children and paid to play.
Yes.
It's very hard work, but you don't have a whole lot of responsibility, which is quite fun.
No, they tell you, I wanted to say they tell you what to do. That's not exactly right.
No, but you are not the responsible person in the end.
No.
So that's, and you know, that's quite nice as you get older, not to have to be the grown-up.
No, I think that's right.
Yeah.
I think that, and I've never heard anybody quite say that. But I understand it really well, the need in your 20s to demonstrate that you're a real person,
yeah.
a serious, right,
yeah.
right, that thing it,
mm-hmm.
that we all, well, not we all, but I think it's a developmental stage,
yeah.
you know, not yeah. everybody gets to do it.
Right, absolutely.
You know,
absolutely.
So, and then having established that for yourself, that's not necessary anymore.
Right.
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 And you can expand
yeah.
as you apparently have.
Yeah.
Okay, so...
Ambition, I have to say, ambition falls by the wayside. When you're having a good time and you're middle-aged, ambition is less important. believe.
I don't think that happens for everybody, but I'm really happy to hear that it happened for you.
Mm.
Because I think it's ideal.
Mm-hmm.
I do.
It's very zen.
It's very zen. I was going to say it's not driven,
mm-hmm.
you know, so yes, it's very zen. It's also not particularly American.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, given my druthers, I think I could be quite happy just traveling around the world with phrase books and being a travel bum. You know, that to me now would be absolutely bliss.
And is that not a possibility?
Well, not full-time, but I do manage to do it probably about 2 months a year, I'd say, so that's not too bad.
Well, you have worked this out extremely well. It sounds to me that this is much better than the university, you know, and the summertime doing, you know, Shakespeare. I mean, it seems to me you've worked it out better for yourself.
It's living on a shoestring all the time, but it's worth it, you know, so.
Yes, Fonda's saying, you know, there's the give for the get.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
Yeah, right. So, where do you live now?
London.
You do?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
And, but here you are in Sarasota, Florida.
I've fallen in love with Sarasota. It's my fifth winter here now.
Wow. Mm. I didn't realize.
Mm.
So, how did that happen?
Well, it happened because of Michael Edwards.
Mm-hmm.
And my partner is actually, her mother retired here. So I've been hearing about the Oslo for a few years, and thought, well, that sounds interesting, who knows, you know. But then Michael I've known and worked with for 28 years, 27 years now, and his career was going up and up, and he would, you know, occasionally phone me and say, will you come and work in Indiana? Where? But thankfully, he landed here.
He's grateful, you're grateful, and we are all grateful.
So that's how, yeah, he... And actually, you know, growing up in California, you do have a sort of certain prejudice against Florida, thinking, rival state and all that kind of thing.
Wait a minute, who grew up in California?
I did.
You grew up in California?
I did, for many, well, a lot of my childhood, yeah.
Oh, I didn't realize you didn't say.
Yeah. Dad went to L.A. to be in the movies.
Yes, he did. Mm. Oh, that's right. You did say. But somehow I decided that you grew up in England.
Ah.
But I got that wrong.
Well, I've spent most of my life in England, so that's why.
I see.
But from the first winter I came here, I am a compulsive bird watcher, and this is kind of heaven for bird watchers.
Heaven. It is. It definitely
Florida
is.
Florida and Australia kind of are the meccas of the bird watching world.
And you don't need a phrase book.
And you don't need to, well...
Well, all right, never mind. All right.
In Miami, you do.
Yes. No, I know. I know. So, this season, you're doing Elamir in Labette and Boing Boing, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
So do you want to talk a little bit about Labette?
Yes, indeed. Labette is an incredibly unusual play, which I saw a production 18 years ago in Oregon, at the Oregon Shakespeare, which was amazing and intriguing. And commercially, you know, the history of the play, that it didn't do very well on Broadway originally, but it has done very well on every regional production that it's had. There's a revival that's just closed in New York that was in London, a very star-studded revival.
I saw it.
Yeah. And...
Did you see it?
I did see it. I wasn't terribly impressed.
Oh, neither was Michael, apparently.
Yeah. Yeah. They didn't really explore the play, it has to be said. It was a star vehicle to show off Mark Rylance.
It's an amazing performance.
It's an amazing performance. He's an amazing actor who needs to be slapped.
And who can slap him?
Well, that's the problem, because he's such a star now that nobody does slap him.
Mm-hmm.
But I've known Mark's work now for 25 years, and I have to say he was an amazing young actor, and he was his own director for many years. He was the artistic director of The Globe, where he did a lot of roles, and that's where he really started to get a bit indulgent, it has to be said.
Yes.
And as talented as he is, he doesn't always serve the play, it has to be said. That production was...
So I'm curious, will you talk about how that the play was not served and how you think you guys did serve it?
What you need to have to make the play work, the audience needs to be able to see both points of view. It has to be balanced. Of course, people will come out on the side of one or the other, often. That is to say, you've got the traditional conservative view of Elamere, that's to say, art is to be respected and to be, you know, a bit precious, and we have rules and defining things that define the rules of good taste and what's high art and what's low art. And the point of Valère, who comes into this, is that popular appeal...
Yeah, there is no low art.
There is no low art. And of course, there are great scholars now who argue this point, saying, well, how do you define low art and high art? You know, there's intelligence in both. They might
this
be...
This is so interesting to me.
Exactly.
Because that's not what I saw at all.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Then that's the point, isn't it? What I saw, or what captured me, was the idea of... sticking to your guns. Right or wrong.
Yeah. Yeah.
Honoring yourself.
Right.
You know, not selling yourself out, so to speak.
Yeah.
That was what...
Yeah. I mean, and that's what they both claim to be doing. Both Valère and Elamere claim to be sticking to their guns and refusing to sell out.
Oh, God, this is so interesting to me, because, of course, I didn't see that at all. I saw that Elamere was doing that, and Valère had no choice. That he was doing what he was doing because he couldn't do anything else. And that Elamere had a choice. He could submit, but he didn't.
He could submit in terms of accepting
this
incomer.
Yes. I mean, maybe this is not... This is just... I'm the only person in the world who...
No, but that's the interesting thing about it, is that you came away with a reaction like that. I don't know if you came away from the Broadway production like that, or from just from our production.
Actually, I saw both. I saw a little of that in both productions. Just the language.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Well, the language is dazzling. The play is a dazzling piece of writing.
It's unbelievable.
Very, very smart writing.
Oh,
very,
my
very
God.
Smart writing. Yeah.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's so... I mean, not... This is not something many people could possibly have done.
No. No, that's an amazing... I mean, to write that smart play in rhyming couplets, in iambic pentameter...
Yes, exactly right. Oh, my God.
In 1990 is kind of extraordinary.
Okay, so... make believe I didn't say anything, and go back and tell me what it was you were aiming for.
Well, we were aiming for... The thing is, when I first saw the play... 18 years ago, I had already worked with Danny a few times, and my first reaction to the play was, Danny has to play this role.
Yeah.
And Michael and I knew that this, he just had to be done. And I knew Danny wanted to play the role. So knowing that you have the perfect Valère, which is an extraordinary part that needs to be someone who can...
And yet again, who else, I mean, you know, you can, I don't know, like, not very many people could do it.
Right.
Right.
Exactly, because he needs to be terribly likable, yet obnoxious in some ways.
Right.
So to carry that balance, but the important thing that Danny does in his performance is that, as dazzling as he is with these kind of verbal pyrotechnics, he always keeps the focus back on, especially in that huge monologue, the focus always comes back to appealing to me, appealing to Elamere to say, I hope we can work together. I hope you want to like me. I hope you want to take me into the company.
Yes.
That he never forgets that. The focus is all about, the drive is always toward that.
Yes, and Mark Rylance didn't do that.
No.
You're right. He didn't do it.
Yeah. Yeah.
And as you are saying this, I realize that I did like Danny and I didn't like Mark.
Mark chose a kind of grotesque.
Yes.
Which was very entertaining.
Well, and also for me, it made a statement. It said, this is unattractive.
Right.
You know. Ooh, how interesting to me.
Yeah. The problem is, why would a royal patron
Like that.
Like him.
Yes, yes. And I remember thinking that when I saw it. Mm-hmm. What could possibly...
Right.
You know, right. And Danny doesn't do that.
Danny is incredibly likable.
And he's ingratiating.
Right.
That's right. That's
and
right.
The battle for me, in a way, is
yes.
He makes my job much harder.
Much harder.
Because he is so likable.
Yes.
That I could end up looking like a stick in the mud.
Yes, that's right.
And that's
your challenge. Exactly. That's right.
Exactly.
That's right. Which you pull off admirably, thank you.
Well, I am happy to say I keep hearing from audience members, and they're kind of evenly divided.
Yes, yes, yes. Well, I was, even with Danny, I was on your side, so...
Well, that's good.
I didn't tell him.
But then you have, I mean, what of course the crux of the play is that patronage or arts funding
mm-hmm.
often is in the hands of people who, you know, don't really have a sophisticated criteria, but they're interested in novelty. They're interested in, so the prince in this case, just is dazzled, he says, I'm dazzled by novelties.
Right.
And look, this guy's got something new and different. I like it.
Right, right. Or it doesn't even have to be novelties. It's whatever it is
right.
that gets their attention.
Right. Exactly.
And they have the... Right.
And rehearsals, we talked about reality television.
Oh, I'm sure.
And we talked about all those kind of issues and politics, and it's all in the play there, built in. And the very, very smart conceit of this play within a play, which... is an absolute microcosm of the larger play.
Yes.
Yeah. Of two rivals and one being supplanted by the other. And again, how much do you remember of the play within a play on Broadway?
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
Right. Wow. This is great. And if you're listening, this is so well worth coming down to see, and you can make your own decisions about what it is and who you're for and what you believe in. Do you want to say a little bit about Boing Boing as long as we're...
Yes, absolutely. Boing Boing is it's going to be a lot of fun. I think we all think of it as this play that was a bit of a war horse in the 60s and 70s. It was, I think, for about 10 years the most performed comedy on stage in the world.
You're kidding.
It was done in every expat community. I can tell you, from having worked overseas, it was done all the time in expat communities.
Wow.
Because it's a very small cast, and it's about people who fly around the world and blah, blah, blah. But the fun of it is to go back and say, of course it's a period piece. We're doing it very much 1969 kind of thing. And the fun of it is to say, not that it's about... It's not really about air travel and the glamour of air travel. It's really about a guy who has the Hugh Hefner, who's buying into the Hugh Hefner fantasy. And almost the way, I keep thinking of the way guys, there are guys out there now who, there's a whole cult of guys who are pickup artists. And they're geeky nerds who read manuals about how to get women.
Oh, is that true?
Yeah, it's true. There's a whole culture out there.
Oh, dear.
It's a sad fact. But the idea that you can read a book and get good at this...
Right.
And, of course, my character in Boing Boing is a guy who's been reading Playboy magazine and buying into the Playboy lifestyle and has managed to line up three fiancés simultaneously. So he thinks he is living the life.
Yeah.
And, of course, what happens in the play is that it all falls apart and he realizes he really doesn't have the nerves for it. Just reading it in the book is not enough. You have to actually be able to walk the walk, and he isn't. When it comes down to it, he's not. Actually, he's relieved to have to settle for one.
Oh, that's lovely. That's lovely, because I never saw the play.
Hmm.
And, you know, this reminds me, there are also books out there for women
mm-hmm.
about, you know,
the rules.
Of the rules, you've read my mind, right? And, of course, none of that stuff works. Like, it's just insane. And, right. And so, of course, this play helps to make that point for...
Yes, I mean, it's complete...
In addition to being fun.
And I have to say, I mean, Jason's performance... So I play the kind of straight man who's trying to live the life, but my bumpkin friend comes from the country and is introduced to the life by me and takes to it like a duck to water.
Ah. Oh, he is a natural.
He is, and it's a comic performance. In the film, it was played by Jerry Lewis, and I have to say, Jason is doing a performance that is amazingly funny.
Really?
So, I mean, I'm working with two brilliant comic actors, so with Labette with Danny and in this one with Jason, so it's a treat to watch him.
That's great. Mm. Oh, that's great. Okay, so if you don't make it to Labette,
you have to see
you
both.
You still have time to get tickets to Boing Boing. All right, so the I'd like to ask, is there anything I didn't ask that I should have?
We have some fantastic plays coming up. I'll be in Death Trap.
Oh, you will? I forgot. Season. You will be in Death Trap. Oh, my God, right. The oh, talk about it.
I don't know much about it yet, I have to say. I just saw it in London a couple of months ago. But again, I think it's another play that we regard as a bit of a hoary old chestnut.
Yes.
But the director promises that we're going to be doing a very rich, camp, sort of 1970s revival that should be really fun as a period piece, and not trying to make it, you know, set in the current now, because it can't.
No, no. I love the play. I know it, and I love it.
Very fun piece.
It's a great piece.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's continually, I mean, it just always works, how I feel about it, you know, I forgot you were in it. Okay, good. So you should come down here and see the entire season, most of which has Brian Tarpey in it. And aren't we glad? No, truly. So, the last question I ask is, and you may already have said everything you have to say about it, but having really dedicated a life to the art of theater in one way or another, mm-hmm. is there anything you want to say about it? You can just
I would just say it's magic, and we need more of it, and people need to go and see more of it.
Yes.
I mean, it is extraordinary to have, I've just had this fantastic experience with my nephew in London, who is the ultimate classic American video kid, and we took him to see War Horse, which is an amazing spectacle in London right now, and we hadn't realized that he had never been to a play. He had been to musicals, a few big musicals, but he had never been to a play, and he came out beaming, saying, "It was better than a movie." I mean, what higher compliment could he get?
How old is he?
He's 11.
Oh, good.
Yeah.
Another generation.
Exactly.
Thank you.
Exactly. So we need more of that.
We do absolutely need more of that, and you are a... you are an actor who makes it possible for people to fall in love with theater.
That's very nice to hear.
So, thank you so much, Brian.
Thank you.
And so there you have Brian Tarpey, who tried in typical teenage fashion to rebel against his parents, only to discover that, ironically, he was actually what his parents wanted him to be. What a trick. And then, having discovered himself, gave himself to it. So, you know, as always, I am hoping that as you are listening to an artist who has given his life, even through the difficult times, to who he really is, that you are reflecting on the ways in which you might be shortchanging yourself, on the ways in which you might be something you are denying, in the ways in which there are things about you which you have not yet surfaced, discovered, been able to enjoy. And if you are doing that, let me encourage you not to rush at it, but simply to daydream about it, to spend some time thinking about it, to imagine what it would be like to be the person you might have been, would have wanted to be. It's very likely not too late. So, and if that's happening to you, then perhaps you want to hang in to listen when I tell you about the relationship contract, which is one of the ways that we are stuck, the relationship contract, which makes it possible for us to interact with the people who are important to us, but also sometimes keeps us from ourselves. So, I think it's time now for me to thank Josh Hackney, as I always do at the end of the show, because truly, I couldn't be doing this without him in so many ways, not only because he fixes the sound, not only because he taught me how to edit, not only because he reminds me how to do the things I need to do, which I have forgotten, but because of all the stuff he knows and the generous way in which he shares it. So if you need somebody to do something with recording, electronics, computers, any of that stuff, you want Josh. And as I always say, you can get him at my website, thelynshow.com, thelynneshow. And you can also get me there, of course. And I believe next week I'm going to be playing an interview with Jason Bradley, who was Brian's co-star in Boeing Boeing, and who you heard Sharon talk about in her review. So if that interests you, and if you heard anything in this show that you can use, something that compelled you, interested you, tickled your imagination, anything that will bring you back, because I will be here next week, and boy, as always, I sure hope you will be too.
You see, I'm getting older, my hair is turning gray. Oh, you say my face and figure have both seen better days. Well, I won't be retiring, I won't slip out of sight. No, I will not go gentle into that good night. I won't go with a whimper, I am going with a bang. Life's a song I keep on singing, not a tune that I once sang. I just keep returning like some goddamn boomerang. No, I won't go with a whimper, I am going with a bang. See that I have had my shot, my time has come and gone. Oh, won't I please get off the stage, let someone else get on. Well, I won't be relegated or leave without a fight. No, I will not go gentle into that good night. I won't go with a whimper, I am going with a bang. Life's a bell I keep on ringing, not a chime that I once rang. You may think it's unseemly, well, I don't give a dang. No, I won't go with a whimper, I am going with a bang. Rising from the ashes, every chance I get. I may be running out of time, but it ain't over yet. 'Cause me and Sister Phoenix, we won't give up the flag. No, no, we will not go gentle into that good night. And I won't go with a whimper, I'm going with a bang. Life's a song I keep on singing, not a tune that I once sang. I may not be as juicy, hell, but I still got some tang. So you won't hear me simper, I may have gotten